along to the Never Knowingly Understood podcast here from Colchester Arts Centre. My name is Tim Morgan and I'm going to be bringing you episode 4, which is entitled Legends. And that's because I had the great pleasure of catching up with two musical icons this month. First up, you'll be hearing an interview with Eliza Carthy, who will be performing at Colchester Arts Centre on Monday the 27th of February. There'll be an interview also with Steve Diggle from Buzzcocks. But first of all is the interview that I did with Eliza Carthy, where we talked about a number of things, including her new album, Queen of the World, which is a collection of songs looking back from her catalogue, where she has re-recorded and reinterpreted. And it's kind of part of the 30th anniversary, unbelievably so. Buckle up, and here we go. And here's Eliza Carthy. Can I, because you've just done some gigs, haven't you?
Yeah, as you can tell by the state of my voice.
And how did they go?
Very well, thank you. Yeah, very well. Well, really outstanding. We had standing ovations for every show, which was wonderful considering actually my voice was in a fairly rotten state when we went on the road to start with. But almost every show sold out, almost every show standing ovation. So it's been lovely. We've been having them up to dance. It's like some of the venues have been quite sort of formal. I was going to say staid, but that's a little unfair. Just formal type venues where it's hard to get people up and jumping, you know. Yeah. So you know, like university places, that kind of thing. The concert halls where people are like, hello, I don't know, am I allowed to be in here? So, but yeah, we had people jumping about for those. So that was those are always the good ones when you turn them around, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one that's coming up at the Colchester Arts Centre, so that's on the 27th of February, so that's going to be a slightly different gig. So you'll be playing with your father, Martin.
Right, yeah. They're not dancing gigs, these ones.
these are more sitting down kind of gigs, are they? Or can people get up and have a little bit of a dance if they want?
No, they're very much more storytelling type gigs. Yeah, we tell stories and we sing ballads. It's mostly songs. We don't do much in the way of instrumentals at the moment. So it's my dad tells some stories, I tell some stories, we have a bit of a laugh. Yeah. And play some miserable folk music, you know, the good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Was music always going to be your chosen path?
Well, I didn't think so, but I was kidding myself, you know. I wanted to be a writer. My big dream when I was a kid was I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to write novels and poetry. That was going to be my thing. I spent many years writing terrible novels and terrible poetry. But then I got round to writing terrible songs instead. So, tunes. It all turned out well in the end, I think.
So how does it feel, sort of, it's just been the 30th anniversary in terms of your kind of solo and sort of musical career? How does it feel like that? Because it doesn't to me.
It's incredible that it's incredible that it's been 30 years. I mean, I still feel 30, you know.
Yeah.
I've been joking on the restitution tour. I have been joking that it's just like, yes, we're celebrating 30 years since I was born. Then I think about some of the early gigs that I did, funnily enough, at the Colchester Arts Centre. I mean, I've been gigging at the Arts Centre for years. I've got a photo shoot that I did with the Chipolatas when me and the Chipolatas did a combined folk club tour, and we came to Colchester, and I remember Sam unicycling around the audience. And we did a photo shoot outside. I was just trying to remember how old I was then. I think that was 1996, yeah, maybe. So you've got to do the numbers.
Yeah,
it really is 30 years ago. It's crazy.
And how many times do you think you've been to the Colchester Arts Centre?
Oh my goodness, I couldn't even tell you. No, it's okay. It's one of my favourite places to play, though. Always.
Oh yeah, no, it's a brilliant venue. It's a fantastic venue, and I think.
Oh my goodness! That just gave me another memory. Sorry,
go on.
I had another memory, and that was touring with the year that Anglicana won Won a bunch of awards at the Folk Awards and also was nominated for the Mercury Prize. I was on tour with the Oyster Band with the Big Session, and we played Colchester Arts Centre the day after the Folk Awards, and I had the most horrific hangover. And I spent most of the sound check lying on the floor, lying on the stone floor. And then they managed to get me up. They managed to get me. They sort of wheeled me on stage for my bit, and then wheeled me back off again. So
Well,
that
you
one was
know,
that was 2004, 2003. Lots of good memories.
I think I saw the Villagers play there, and it was just after he'd been given, is it an Ivan Novello Award, or he'd just something like that. And he was slightly refreshed when he was playing on stage, understandably. But yeah, you like to describe yourself as a modern English musician, I think.
That was a long time ago now, but it's still true. I think
Yeah.
when I said that, when I said that, I was trying to ally myself with other musicians my age that were also experimenting with.
Yeah.
I tend to think of modern English musicians as people who are willing to just open their minds and open doors to lots of different kinds of music and to see what. You know, I like open-minded music. I like open-minded audiences,
Yeah.
and I wanted to bring English folk music, English traditional music, up alongside other musicians who are trying different things from whatever genre. I think at the time that I said that, certainly world music was very, very popular, and obviously Celtic music has always been very, very popular. And I just wanted to, I suppose, in my mind, bring my genre up alongside those people, because I felt that our genre was ignored somewhat or considered somewhat backward. And that's where I felt the need to use the word modern, because although the music that we play, the origins of the music that we play is very old, we are people of our time, and the guitar isn't a traditional instrument. The violin isn't a traditional instrument. And over the years, both my father and myself have done lots and lots of different things with traditional music. You know, whether it be electrifying, or in my case, doing electronic dance music, or really, collaborating with people from different walks and different genres of music, different cultures. And I think that's all modern English music. You know, we like to make connections. We like to play with other people who have interesting stories, interesting things to tell, whether it be from traditional music from these islands or from wherever else. So I think that's what I was trying to get out with that.
Yeah. And do you think that now, I mean, certainly from my point of view, that people aren't so sort of hung up on genres now anyway? I think it's whether they like a piece of music. And I suppose that kind of roots music and folk music and country music and very much the storytelling is now maybe much more part of the kind of mainstream in a way, in terms of it's reaching a bigger audience.
It's interesting, yeah. I mean, the Spotify argument rumbles on for professional recording musicians, but I think one of the upsides of streaming music, of free streaming music, which I think none of us saw coming. And as a teacher at the moment, I'm teaching secondary music at the moment at my old school just for until May. And one of the interesting things for me, and also having children sort of approaching and in their teenage years, is that playlists and streaming take you places that you might not necessarily choose to go. And the labels are much less delineated than they used to be. And yeah, unless someone is a full-on emo or a full-on whatever, quite a lot of children listen to many different genres of music and across time in a way that my generation really didn't. I was unusual. I was unusual in the 80s in that I listened to Motown, I listened to like 50s doo-wop and things like that, in alongside classical music and things like that. And I was considered a real anomaly, you know. I mean, I was a geek. I wasn't listening to Stock Aitken and Waterman like all my peers were, you know, or I wasn't just into the Smiths or, you know, that kind of thing. So I was a bit of an anomaly, but I've found that a lot more children these days are much more eclectic in their taste. And I think another thing that's had a real positive impact on the kind of music that kids listen to is gaming, is actually gaming, because I have found traditional music in the strangest of places. Like there's Assassin's Creed has a shanties area, like a secret area where you can go and there's shanty music playing. My son plays this game, this like a it's like a pirate game, I guess, where you can walk around playing the banjo. There's another game with a little creature who's a ball of he's like a ball of string. His name's Yarny, and the music for that is all done by this incredible Swedish fiddler and composer, and the music is all just absolutely stunning Scandinavian fiddle music. So you know, these things pop up in the strangest of places, like the TikTok shanty craze. Who knew that that was going to be a thing? Who knew that the Wellerman was ever going to happen? You know, I love that. I love that there's Fisherman's Friends movies out there now and things like that. It's great, and it's kind of what I wanted. I wanted traditional music to be popping up all over the place, and for it not to be a thing. And the fact that you know, I felt all kind of like, well, I've been doing shanties for years, kind of thing, and no one's ever noticed. And then I thought, hang on a minute, this is exactly what I wanted. I don't want it to be all about me. I want it to be coming from all directions, you know? And I actually went, you know what? Good luck to them all. Good luck to everybody. It's fabulous. Everything widens the pool, and that's, you know, if I'm not going to be a hypocrite and I'm going to say, you know, and I have to say, well done to the world. That's just great. That's exactly what I said I wanted. So come on, bring it on, you know.
No, absolutely. And I think that no matter how people get things, it's got to be a good thing that people experience things that they might not otherwise have had the chance to, really.
I've always contended that the number one problem with English traditional music has just been access. So you put it in front of people's faces, and 9 times out of 10 they love it. And even the weird stuff, you know, even the Morris dancing and the, you know, all of it, the weirder the better. I don't know if you saw Wet Leg on the Brit Awards the other night. It was just fabulous to see a load of Morris dancers, young female Morris dancers, and their mama's monsters dancing with them, with this just incredible punk girl band. You know, it's just brilliant. You know, you put it in front of people's faces, and even if it's weird, they love it, and they love it because it's weird, which is wonderful.
Absolutely. And I think stuff like that will always maybe court different opinions, but it's there because it's good.
And no one was taking the mick. No one was taking the mick out of anything. It was just there because it was cool. And it was like, this is cool. And I felt so proud that Sam Sweeney was in the owl costume. I was like, I know you and I know your friends. I'm so proud. I was proud of him and I was proud of me, you know. I was just proud of our community. We really represented, you know. It's great, wonderful.
Your recent album, Queen of the World, was that what was because you've gone back and recorded or reinterpreted some of your songs from across the years. What was the kind of what was the driving desire? Why did you suddenly decide that that was what you wanted to do?
It was because of my current band, to be honest. I was approached. I was approached 2, 3 years ago by this fellow Brian Blinkerhoff in Santa Cruz, who said, "I'm a small independent label, and I make heavy grade vinyl singles with beautifully hand painted sleeves. Would you like to be one of my artists?" And another one of his artists is Malcolm McWatt, who I did some playing for on his last album, Settler. And I said, "Oh yes, please. That sounds lovely." And we made this beautiful single called Night Swimming, beautiful red vinyl, absolutely beautiful thing with a gorgeous painted cover. And then when we'd done that, he said, "Well, you know, what are you doing at the moment?" And I said, "Well, we're coming out of the pandemic, and I have to promote. Well, I had to promote Restitute and an album called Through That Sound. My secret was made known, which I made with a producer in Fife called Ben Seal, who's now in my band." I said, "We have to promote that, but you know, my 30th anniversary is coming up, and I'm looking to, you know, to mark that in some way." And he said, "Well, how do you fancy doing a?" He says, "If you, you know, have you got any musicians that you would choose to work with?" And I'd been working with the Restitution, putting together the promotional tour for Restitute and Through That Sound, when the doors came down, if you like, when you know, we were rehearsing about 3 days before lockdown. And then we did the tour, and we found that the six of us enjoyed playing together so much. I mean, everyone in the band has been in one of my lineups at some point, and some of them have played with each other, but some of them haven't, sort of thing. And it was just such a great combination of people and musicians that I basically said to them, "Look, I've been offered the chance to make this 30th anniversary album. This lineup is working really, really well. How do you fancy reinterpreting a whole load of my stuff?" And they just said, "Yeah, that, you know, the Restitution has become a real, it's just a real band, you know, it's a fantastic, fantastic band." And so I then went about talking. I was talking to my followers on Twitter and saying, "Look, I've just this list is just so long," and I can't remember who suggested it, but we just said, I was just like, "Right, how about if I make a poll, how do you feel about you guys choosing?" sort of thing. And I have my little core of crazy fan mates who all went, "Yeah, we'll do it," and a load of other people sort of just went, "Yeah, come on. Let's see what you got." So I wrote the list, and we got it whittled down to 15 songs, and then we just went into the studio, and I said to the band, there are a couple of arrangements that I don't want to change, but otherwise let's just dive in as the people we are now. I mean, some of them are replaying things that they played, you know, on the original recordings. Some of them are visiting those recordings for the first time. Let's not, you know, let's not stick to the script. Let's have some fun, and that's what they did. So we went into the studio, we rehearse everything in the morning and record it in the afternoon, much as the same way as I did with my father with The Moral of the Elephant. It's just like brand new stuff. Here we go. This is us approaching it now. What do we sound like now? And as it turns out, we just come off the road. We were very tight, working together very well. And the 15 songs just came out absolutely brilliantly. So that's how we did it. It was because of the guys that I get to work with now.
And touring and playing those songs, what's the kind of next steps, do you think? Are you already thinking of new music? Because I can imagine you're probably writing and performing all the time, aren't you?
Well, as I say, I'm working in this job at the moment, which is fabulous. I'm enjoying having access to different instruments every day. I've been playing the drums, I've been playing the cello, I've been getting back into playing the piano a little bit, because I unintentionally dropped the piano a few years ago. Never meant to do it, but I just never got around to it, you know. So I've been kind of reteaching myself a little bit of piano again, bit of theory and all that, and that's great. And I am wondering, you know, what's coming next. So Through That Sound really needs a good shout on the road. It needs a good proper tour. We did like a little 2 week tour, but it needs to come out and be distributed properly. So there's that. As far as new music is concerned, I'm writing a trio album with David Dillard, my guitarist, and Saul Rose, my ex-brother-in-law and melodeon player. So we're writing an album currently. We're going into the studio next month to finish recording that. It's called Conversations We've Had Before, mainly because we've had lots of conversations about how we should make an album. So that's happening. But then at some point, there's always another traditional album to make. Hopefully, I would make it with the Restitution, and then there would be another contemporary album to make with Ben. I also, you know, I have to work with my dad. We still haven't made an album of the East material, although East. We were very sorry to lose Wilco Johnson from the East lineup. Obviously, he passed away years. That was very, very sad. So there's that material to look at as well. There's there's always more. I very much like to keep working with this band. I very yeah. much like work, keep writing with Ben, and you know, hopefully do something new with my dad very, very soon as well. So yeah, there's lots to do.
Is it just, have you just made the one out?
Just one, yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, that's coming up to, is that like 9 years ago now, is it?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so you got to have one out before the 10th anniversary, I would think, really.
That would be good. We've been handed a bit of repertoire in a collection of songs from Robin Hood's Bay, which is where we live, where I was right. born. So I think we might be taking a look at that at some point. Although, as I say, we do have the East project to record. There's talking of an Imagine Village reunion at some point as well. So, just want to cram it all in, you know. But you have to be careful because you don't want to put lots of stuff out all at once and have people miss stuff. I also have an album to record with this year. I'm of course touring with John Bowden in the winter. So I'm very, very much looking forward to getting into the studio with John and recording our Christmas album, because we're going to be, hopefully, fingers crossed, the idea. John phoned me up and he said, I want to do a Christmas tour with you every year until we die. And I'd always said to everybody, you know, if I ever make a Christmas album, shoot me. As far as I was concerned, it was artistic death to make a Christmas album. You know, I think maybe I'm slowing down. Maybe I'm getting old.
Well, I mean, our perspectives on things do change slightly, don't they, as we kind of move further down the road, I suppose. Oh, well, that would be great. That would be really great. So that's a definite to come out for this Christmas or before Christmas?
That is a definite, yes. We're about to announce our tour dates. That's happening in the next couple of weeks. I believe we're announcing on the 1st of March, we'll be announcing all the tour dates.
Excellent.
So, and then we're going into the studio in May to record the album. So I guess the next two things you're gonna see out of me will be the trio album, something with Through That Sound, and the Christmas record. But I don't know what order.
Because obviously you've collaborated with so many people. And so many different kind of people. I guess you've kind of collaborated with people like Paul Weller and Patrick Wolfe and Rufus and Martin Wainwright. Is there anyone on your kind of wish list that maybe you haven't collaborated with that you would think I'd quite fancy a go at that? Or
At some point, I would like to record something with Kay Tempest, because I did we did a performance together for the Six Music Festival, which was broadcast live, but we haven't managed to make it into a studio yet. I did invite them onto the Wayward Band record, but they were writing their book at the time, and they were just far too busy. So hopefully there'll be a day where we can get together. I'd also like to do something with Richard Hawley, because again, we've performed live together. We haven't actually managed to record anything yet. So, yes, I'd like to do something with him. That'd be lovely.
Yeah, that would be remarkable.
There's plenty of girls out there that I'd love to work with as well. So,
and thank you to Eliza Carthy for taking her time out from her busy schedule to speak to me. And if you're coming along to the gig here on Monday, the 27th of February, you're in for an absolute treat. Now, coming up is our regular feature in which Mick, the resident Arts Centre hippie, tells us about the forthcoming events that will be coming up in March. Mick's picks are like a celestial flying teapot ride around a patchouli-scented galaxy, guaranteed to bring wonder and open the doors of perception.
Well, Mick's picks for March 2023. It's a bit of a weird one, this, because we've got so much sold out stuff that there's no point me picking it as it might be. So let's do a couple of folk gigs. The 13th, Cara Dillon. The 20th, Chris Wood. That's a bit more traditional folky. Mick's picks, you want the two? They're the two.
After managing to just about compose myself after speaking to Eliza Carthy, I was almost sent into a state of shock when I then followed it up by speaking to Steve Diggle from Buzzcocks, a band that I have greatly adored since my teenage years. And it was an absolute pleasure to hear about the process he went through with the making of the new Buzzcocks album, and also the fact that it was the first album, sadly, to be recorded without Pete Shelley. So listen in, and I hope you enjoy.
At the moment, you've been on tour with From the Jam?
Yes, we've been doing some gigs with them, yeah. And we've been doing our own ones as well. And we've recently been doing From the Jam ones, yeah.
And how's that been going?
Yeah, really good, you know. It's a good combination, really. But I've known Bruce for years, and they have those gigs booked, and we said, oh, we'll just join you for that, because we was in an interim period. We'd done some shows and stuff. The manager's just died as well, so we joined From the Jam for this tour, and it's been great, really, great combination, yeah.
That's a top bill, really, isn't it? You can't really beat that, I don't think. I think you're going back on the road with them, is it late March into May? And then...
Yes.
You've got some of your own gigs coming up in March, one of which is the Colchester Arts Centre.
True.
Which is on the 18th of March, which is a Saturday. It's sold out incredibly quickly. There's a huge buzz around it. Have you played in Colchester before?
I can't remember playing in Colchester, no. I'm sure some avid fan might know out there. I can't remember, but... If we haven't, this will be a first, won't it?
It will. Well, I think it'll certainly be a first for the Arts Centre, which is a lovely old church, which has got a brilliant PA system in, and it's on a Saturday night.
Yeah.
So I think everybody's going to be well up for a good evening out. How have you found the new album going down? Because I mean, it came out to terrific reviews, and I think the fans have really been loving it.
Yeah. I thought before we started touring, we need a new album out to make us relevant, you know, because we've got that great back catalogue of stuff. So, yeah, everybody's received it really well, you know. It's kind of got elements of things of the past, but also pointing in the future as well, you know. But it's been received really well, and it's pretty good.
I think it's really, really kind of, you're absolutely right, because I think it is something that's kind of going forward, but it has got those little classic Buzzcocks elements in it, you know, the little guitar riff, right?
Yeah, all the guitar riffs, a few chugs here and there that we're known for and things. And thing is, I tried to make it like an early 70s album as well, where you have to listen to the whole album. So, I one song links into the other. As I was writing it, and the first time I've done this, normally we used to record a whole bunch of songs and then you kind of sequence them together. That's kind of the usual way. But this one, as I was writing it, we need one of those kind of songs and then one of those. And it's kind of thought like when you read a book, you have to start at the beginning and you have to get to the end before you realise what the book's about, usually. So I tried to make the album like that. So it's like old concepts, not a concept of anything in particular, but, didn't want to go that far down the line with it. But I wanted them all to link in and emotional journey as well as like a lyrical journey of it all. So I think it's worked well like that. And it has had amazing reviews, and which is really good, really. It sort of takes us forward. It's pretty good to, you know, it's a good reaction. I mean, it kind of felt good in the studio, but you never know till it's out there, you know. And, that's given us the strength. It was always the songs that were our strength anyway. So, I mean, it's given that. And we do quite a few new ones in the set, about three. Or we do more depending on time. Maybe we'll do a few more at the Arts Centre as well, because the new ones fitting well with the old ones, which is sit side by side together well.
Because it came out in September, and I think it was last January, I saw you play at Rockaway Beach. And did you drop any of the new ones in there?
I think we might have done one or two. Yeah, the first single was Senses Out of Control. So yes, we did that. Yeah, and then the second single, Manchester Rain, and there's a song called Bad Dreams. We're doing that's the like a chuggy one that takes it in a different way. I can't remember whether we did those. We did.
Well, I think you might. Yeah, I think you might have done Senses Out of Control. There were definitely one or two in there that were new to me. They just sit at perfectly within the set, you know. I mean, I think they are, well, I should imagine they're already established Buzzcocks songs now, that it's got that same energy. I think also it's the ideal album because it's what an album should be. It's 35 minutes long, I think, which is, yeah, as you say, you listen to the whole thing. How was the process, because that was the first kind of recordings as Buzzcocks without Pete. Was the intention always to kind of carry on because of the, you know, the songs you have and the fan base you have out there and the fact that there was more to do?
Yes, well, when Pete sadly died, I mean, it was a massive emotional thing, you know. I mean, 43 years we've been together, so it was a massive thing. And we had the Albert Hall books, Royal Albert Hall in London, and as a Buzzcocks gig, but then it turned into a memorial show. And then we had some other shows booked. I think everybody was in a state of, you know, disorientation with it all. And we did the other shows that were already booked. One was on a rock and roll boat from Barcelona to Sardinia. That was amazing. I never thought I'd be playing on a boat. But it became a big family, that boat. It was fantastic, you know. But so we carried on doing the gigs, and it was kind of like, and the fans were, a lot of fans were saying, carry on, Steve, and all this. And so they're happy I've sort of still kept it alive, you know, and keeping some of Pete's songs alive and my own. So in that way, so when we get to the studio, I mean, it was kind of cathartic for me. I just kind of put my head down. I mean, the bass player and drummer were in 2 days, and I said, leave it to me now. So I did the guitars and the vocals, you know, over a period of time in between shows. So, I mean, in the later days of Buzzcocks, we used to do that anyway. Pete would go in and do the backing tracks with the bass and drums, and then I would go in. So it kind of saved time and stuff. And if we were kind of still off writing them at home, he'd be like, will you do yours, and then I'll go and do mine, and then I'll come and join you on yours. There was a bit like that anyway, really, you know. Sometimes I'd say, I don't need to know the chords of yours, so you just go in and do it, and I'll come and join it on after. So, you know, it was straightforward, really. And I wrote the album during COVID, so I kind of knew the songs well, in a way, before we went in as well. So it was like, just let's get them down in sequence. Like I said, that sequence, that whole idea to do it like that, you know. Yeah. The working title was Tempest Wind, and then when you're doing an album, you're not sure how the whole thing's going to turn out, in a way. It's kind of exciting, and then you just came to me one day, I thought, Sonics in the Soul, that's what it is. And I said to the engineer, what do you think about that? Because I'd not told anybody the title, because I wasn't really sure, you know.
Yeah.
Well, Tempest Wind was the title, working title. And then Sonics in the Soul seemed to suit the whole thing, you know. It was pretty good, because the bass player and drummer are good, and they'd known me well for years doing that. So it was quite easy to do, in a way.
Yeah.
Apart from coming up with the songs, which seemed to flow as well. I can't look back at it now. If I listen to it, I think, how did I do that? You know, you kind of get lost in the moment of it. You know, in the months and the time, and then come all absorbed. And then looking back, it's like, what a journey that was, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really, really great album. And I did wonder about the process, because obviously previously, pretty much it would have been 50-50 in terms of your songs and Pete's songs on an album. Did you feel a lot of pressure on yourself in order to, I don't know, did you feel a lot of pressure in terms of having to have the whole kind of album, you know,
interesting that, yeah, because we'd put a single out after Pete died, and we did 11 dates before COVID. I said, we you know, we've got to have at least a single out to make it, you know, relevant for now, and not just doing the hits, you know. So I was happy to do any back catalogue, but it was like, we still need to move forward with it. So I'd done the single, Got to Get Better, and Destination Zero.
Yeah.
I think I like the B-side better, Destination Zero, which we do live. Never told the manager which one it was. He said, you should have told me. I said, I thought you knew. So this, but, you know, so I'd done the single, and like you say, so suddenly I'd come to the album, and I thought, hold on, when we normally do an album, Pete'll have half of his songs and I'll have half of mine, and I'll join him on some, I'll put some riffs on his and his.
Yeah.
And it was about halfway, you know, I had about four or five songs, and I thought, yeah, you know, I've got to change the dynamic of this, you know, because there would be a Pete song and a Steve song and all this. And I thought, because I've done quite a few solo albums, so I thought, I don't want to make it, it's got to be a Buzzcocks album, not a Steve Diggle album, which is a fine line, which is kind of the same thing now, but in different in a way. And one of the reasons of sequencing it like that, and also I changed my voice on a few things as well, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say, because that was quite noticeable. I mean, even going back and listening to the last album you did with Pete, I think it was This Way Up in 2014.
Mm.
The vocals,
it was lockdown, so I never slept. You know, some of these songs I was getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, you'd go to bed and get up an hour later and go, that's it, I've got that bit, you know. So I'm scribbling things down in the middle of the, you know, that lockdown, it was time, it was all timeless, wasn't it? It didn't matter whether you got up early in the morning or late, you wasn't really going anywhere. So I was doing all that, but also at the time, I was reading an interesting book about Bob Dylan, and then some sort of intellectual book about Bowie that I'd come across, and other things. And it kept going on about the voices, you know, the many voices of Bob Dylan and the many voices of David Bowie. And I thought, yeah, you know, because when you think, even like David Bowie started off with that Starman thing, and then, you know, down the line, it's Station to Station, My Little China Girl. But everybody still thinks it's David Bowie, you know what I mean? The voice changed. Same with Bob Dylan, he used to sing high, and he sings different every time. So that was interesting. So I kind of took that on board a little bit as well. I thought, I'll get in little bits of the Pete areas and then go back to me, you know, the Steve areas and all that, and try and let it blend like a fine whiskey. Pete would like that because he likes a bit of whiskey in it. So I tried to do a blend of my voices like a whiskey, you know. And I come quite fascinated with that as well, you know, being a big Dylan and Bowie fan and all that kind of thing, you know, having that sort of different sense with the voice. So it's a bit playful on this album with that. But also it's kind of finding a new voice of a mixture of those things,
sure,
you know, to take it from the past to the future. You know, I never thought I'd be doing this. Normally I'd have my corner and Peter'd have his corner with me, you know, but it's an interesting thing, you know.
Yeah.
And the song Manchester Rain, I thought, I've got to sing it in a Manchester accent, really.
Yeah. How do you find that when you're kind of like obviously playing the set live? Because obviously you're using all these different voices. Is it kind of quite a natural thing to kind of change when you change to the different songs or?
Yeah, I mean, what happens is, you know, you become the actor or part of that song.
Yeah.
But also, doing all this touring now, what was noticeable about different voices and different things when I started out and it preparing for this album, suddenly now it's blended together and it's become part of a new voice, if you like, you know. You know, so I can do the kind of higher ones and the lower ones and the sound and the inflections of it. And it's become like a new voice that makes sense. But yeah, you know, I ride the waves of the songs with that. But it's not a conscious thing now, you know. When I started experimenting with that, it was a bit of a conscious thing, you know. Yeah, I'll do the high one, you know, I'll do the low one, you know, or that kind of sound and this sound. And but now it's become kind of another thing. And as I've been doing this set, I've been finding new voices or new things to pull into the voice. Same voice, but it's a kind of... It's interesting for me, you know, it's a fascinating journey to pull all these things in. It's to pull all these things in your voice, you know, the phrasing, the nuances of it and all that, you know. And I kind of like that now. It makes it interesting to sing it as well, because I'm singing it in different ways to different crowds. You know, it would be hardly noticeable to people, but then it's a little giving it different senses. And also, it's, once you record an album and you take it out on the road, you find out more about the songs you recorded, and it goes into these other things. So hopefully I'll have new voices on the next album.
Yeah, and talking of the kind of like the next album, obviously this one's only recently come out. I mean, are you already kind of thinking about new material or thinking about new songs, or have you had a chance to even do that?
Yeah, I've got at least 5 or 6 new songs already,
Oh,
but I'd run record it next week. I suppose we've got to let this one digest a little bit, because it had a fantastic reaction, you know. I mean, little Stephen, he has that underground garage show in America. He loved the song. He actually remixed a new radio edit for it.
Oh, really? Oh, excellent.
But his show, yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
He said, Steve, I love that. I kind of known him from quite a few years ago, actually, but he said, can I do a special radio edit for the show? I said, sure, you know. And they've been playing the album out there all over America on that underground show. And Rodney Bingenheimer as well, he loves it.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, all over here, you know, so it's all good stuff and up and positive in a way, you know, I mean, in terms of what we're doing.
Yeah.
And like with this album, I think it kind of makes us, you know, the new statement. I do want to take it further. Well, while I can still do it and everything, and the crowds have been amazing, you know. The thing is about doing the live set is kind of choose the hits that people know, and then some obscure, well, not obscure, but lesser known album tracks.
Yeah.
And then songs off the new album. So it's a 3-tier set, but that's a lot to cram in an hour and 20 minutes. I mean, I'd play for 2 hours, you know. Every gig we've done, they keep saying, like, we want more. You know, it's too short, the set.
I mean, I think that people would be very happy for you to play for 2 hours. and certainly, you know, if you wanted to at the Arts Centre, I'm sure we could do that.
I think, well, we'll extend it a bit anyway, hopefully, for this, because when did we play? We played at Tunbridge Wells, it was, yeah. We sort of went off, and then the encore, we did half the new album and some of the songs. It was one of them places where, well, if they don't mind here, we'll carry on. And, to be honest, we hadn't rehearsed off the songs off the new album, only the new album songs we're going to play live. And it's like, well, let's just do this one. And that was quite amazing, you know. And we covered a lot of ground there, you know. That's the thing. It'd be nice to do that. Maybe we'll squeeze a few in there. Squeeze a few extra ones, I mean, off.
Can I just ask you as well, because you mentioned the Royal Albert Hall gig, just kind of going back. Now, I was lucky enough to have my ticket. I originally had the ticket when it was going to be the kind of anniversary. And as you say, it kind of turned into a celebration. And it was a wonderful evening. I mean, the bit at the beginning with the video with Howard Devoto and the kind of introduction, and then all of the guests. I mean, it was just the kind of waves of love from the audience. You could just feel it. I mean, I was sitting in the audience. It was just a fantastic evening. It must have been very mixed emotions for you.
Yes, I mean, there was a lot of love there. You could feel it, like, say, from the crowd, couldn't you? And it was a very powerful thing, really, you know. I felt very emotional about it. And we had all those lovely guests and stuff. And it was, what a great tribute to Pete and stuff. And old people had turned up and everything, you know. It's kind of funny as well, because some of the guests couldn't remember the words on their bus. That's in the true spirit of punk, really.
There was definitely a little bit of that. And I think Captain Sensible seemed to be having a good time, I think, really. And everyone did. And
it was a great night, wasn't it? It was an amazing night for all that. Because I remember I sat on that Victoria and Albert monument for a moment, and then some of the fans were there. You know, it was a lovely summer's day, wasn't it? And some of the fans, you know, they'd come from Newcastle and everywhere, you know, for that special thing. So it was an amazing night that, for that.
Yeah.
And we couldn't give Pete a better tribute, I don't think.
No. Yeah, no, I think so. And I think that that's... And then obviously you kind of went off and then you did some shows shortly afterwards. And I think that that was... Yeah, I mean, I think that the fans are obviously really pleased that the Buzzcocks are out there making great new music and playing live. And you're going to get a very good reception when you come to Colchester. I can guarantee that.
Well, the band's lively and we've got all those tunes and songs and people sing along. And then when they have to concentrate on some, that it, you know, the gigs have been fantastic, you know. Really electric. Last weekend we did Edinburgh and Glasgow, and that was amazing. Well, everywhere we played, you know, I don't know what it is about. I don't know if it's the nature of the songs or the band, the great players and that. And that. But there's a lot of magic there, you know. It's emotional, but in a kind of positive and heavy, mysterious way, and all kinds of ways. But
yeah.
Most people that have seen us, they've been surprised, really. it's blown them away, really. You know?
Yeah.
Some Scottish girl put on my Facebook, that was mesmerising, and I thought, well, that's a new way of looking at it. But it's kind of got them qualities somehow. But, you know, we engage with the audience as well. Yeah. That's the thing. That's what I learned over the years. It's kind of, I know what I'm doing, but I want to know what you're doing out there as well, you know, the audience. And then it cuts down that divide, you know, brings us all together. We can kind of go.
And I think that's evident. I think that that's really kind of evident that there is that engagement and, you know, that the audience are feeling that. And I think that is part of it, apart from the fact that, you know, the songs are fantastic. I mean, obviously the older songs are timeless, but the new songs just, they've moved forward, but they just fit and they just make complete sense. And I think it's really great that you're trying all of these new voices out. And it's
like I said, that was like that voice thing was kind of like, well, there's no peak, maybe I can compensate for that. And then it got into a whole new world of it, you know. And also, I mean, there's a lot of political undertones on this album without the obvious finger pointing, you know.
Yeah.
I've always said, it's no good me telling, I don't want somebody telling me the government's wrong. We all know that kind of thing, you know. There's a lot more complexity, really, in the songs. But, you know, there's songs like Don't Mess With My Brain and Existential Bits, Nothingless World. A lot of the fans are interested in that album in terms of the lyrics and the way it goes and all that sort of stuff. A lot of young fans as well. What's kind of weird is, I mean, it's 4 years since Pete's gone. I can't believe it. I keep thinking it's kind of a year and a half or less. But we've gathered a lot of new fans. We've been doing all this touring, and it's the first time a lot of people have seen us, you know. In fact, when we did that boat after the elbow, a couple flew from Canada to see us on this boat, and they said, that's the first time we've seen you, you know, that was great and all that stuff. And I thought, that's weird, because I thought, I felt a bit bad thing, you should have saw it with Pete as well, for once, you know. I know this is good, but, you know. And so there's a lot of people seeing us for the first time as well like that, but they're into it.
I mean, I guess that, you know, new audiences will always discover, you know, artists that have such a classic back catalogue and are continuing to make... And, you know, it's from a period of time. It's hugely important to so many people. It really did kind of change the world. And Buzzcocks, I guess, certainly it was those perfect short kind of pop songs. But they're those perfect songs that people can just kind of engage with straight away.
Yeah, it felt like we were dealing with the human condition, you know.
Yeah.
I always think that maybe, you know, kind of instant for people like you say to think, I've felt like that or I feel that a bit. You know what I mean? A bit of not singing about things that are beyond reach of anybody. It's kind of like that real thing, you know. With its life's imperfections and everything else. So I think everybody could relate to us that way. And we did wrap it up in, you know, good melodies and riffs and stuff like that. And I think it was accessible, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Examine the lyrics, there's a lot of complexity in them also. But that's the that's the art form here, I suppose, is doing that, you know. But yeah, everybody could relate to us easy. That was the thing, you know.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. You know, and we're really looking forward to seeing you at the Colchester Arts Centre on the 18th of March.
We're really looking forward to this one as well. I mean, we really are, yeah.
And thanks once again to Steve Diggle for taking time out to speak to me. And he'll be here performing with Buzzcocks on Saturday, the 18th of March. So if you've got your ticket, I'll see you there. I'll be the chap in the purple Buzzcock shirt. And next up, Dr. Anthony Roberts.
Hello, this is Dr. Anthony Roberts in his ongoing series, Never Knowingly Understood, as published in the Daily Gazette and the Colchester County Standard. I went to the post office to buy a stamp for a letter. Simple. What could possibly go wrong? A lot, it would seem. First obstacle was the cashier trying to sell me home insurance. No thanks, just a stamp, please. The expression I received upon repeating this request was one of disdain mixed with pity in equal measure. The thought of expression a teenager might deliver to a parent who's just asked what makes TikTok so interesting. Contempt, utter contempt. And just when did they start selling home insurance at the post office anyway? In my world, a post office sells stamps and distributes pension money and lives in a dedicated building called the Post Office on Head Street and not tucked away at the back of W.H. Smith's. In my world, Marks and Spencer's just sells clothes, not fancy foods, and a company called Virgin just sells records at shops called Virgin Records. I'm told this is all about diversifying to survive. I heard the new head of Royal Mail on the radio the other day explaining that there was no profit left in letters anymore and it was only parcels where real money was to be made. Which makes me wonder, what will happen when parcels are no longer profitable? Will Royal Mail switch to burgers and fast food? Hello, I'm here to buy some stamps. Certainly, sir. Would you like fries and home insurance with that? Eat in or take away? Talking of fast food, the most iconic and the highest profile brand of all outlets is still McDonald's. For their branding, whatever their new product, all they do is simply add the prefix of Mc to everything. So, for instance, the new veggie burger is called the McPlant burger. Genius! So what happens when McDonald's needs to diversify? When people no longer fancy a Big Mac for their tea? Maybe they could fit their branding to apply it and apply it to all sorts of other exciting products and services. When the fast food money wagon eventually comes to a grinding halt, they could expand into other areas as far away from fast food as buying aeroplanes is from the original Virgin Records idea. The Justice and Prison Service. Now they are crying out for further privatisation, are they not? McDonald's would make a grand job of running these. Strange Ways could be rebranded very simply as McStrange Ways. And before the McJudge passed McSentence on the convicted felon, the McVictim could make a statement to the effect that the judge should abandon the 12 McLife sentences in favour of the McDeath sentence. In fact, the whole criminal justice system could be neatly streamlined in one of their drive-through facilities. You arrive at the queue, announce your crime in the speaker unit, and collect your sentence at the next available window. The newly branded McRoyal Mail could ditch not only letters, but parcels too, along with any semblance of delivering anything at all or providing any public service whatsoever. It could actually just operate as a giant hedge fund with no post offices, no post boxes, no posties, or any of that pesky non-profitable nonsense to get in the way of delivering McProfits year on year. Maybe we should just let Amazon Prime take over everything. I mean everything. Government, education, the church, the universe. Yes, the universe. It could start small, perhaps by just sending someone into space, someone high up in the company maybe, But after that, it could expand into infinity. After all, infinity's been running at a loss for what seems like eternity.
Thanks for popping by and listening in. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast, episode number 4. I'm just going to go and retire to a darkened room and fan myself. If you'd like to listen to more podcasts, then click on the link on the Colchester Arts Centre webpage, or pop along to Spotify or your usual podcast providers. And we'll be back. We'll be back for episode 5, God willing. See you soon. Thank you.